American OnSite LLC versus Zurich American Insurance. Okay, Mr. Gunter.
Your Honor, may it please the court, my name is Justin Gunter, and along with my colleague Bill Holly, I represent North American OnSite LLC, or NAOS, in this appeal. NAOS asked the court to reverse the district court summary judgment order for two reasons. First, the district court erred by finding that the damages that NAOS was legally obligated to pay to a 401k plan as a result of clerical errors that NAOS made in administering the plan were not an out-of-pocket loss covered by the policy. Mm-hmm. Second, the district court erred by holding that Zurich preserved this non-coverage defense, even though Zurich omitted the defense from its purported reservation of rights denying coverage. And when I address the second error, I will also address the Aegis Electric decision that the court asked us to review.
Doesn't that pretty much resolve that question? No.
Your Honor,
the coverage issue we've held would be properly before us, it seemed to me.
Your Honor, we contend that the dicta commentary in the Aegis Electric footnote is not binding on this court because it was a dicta commentary. If you look at the Aegis Electric decision, what was at issue in that decision is whether the insurer had a duty to defend the insured. And there were three potential types of damages that could give rise to that duty to defend. One was attorney's fees, one was compensatory damages, and one was penalties. Mm-hmm. In the Aegis Electric decision, this court held that attorney's fees were potentially covered under the policy, and as a result, there was a duty to defend. Because those attorney's fees by themselves gave rise to the duty to defend, the court's remaining discussion on whether the compensatory damages and penalties had been preserved or were waived, including the footnote addressing the Hoover decision of the Georgia Supreme Court, were dicta and not necessary to the court's decision. In fact, this was the exact observation that Judge Wilson pointed out in his dissent when he stated that it was not necessary to address the Georgia Supreme Court's Hoover decision, and that he would have preferred to not comment on that decision because he thought it was a more complex issue of state law that the court would be better to address later.
Well, let's go to your first issue. I think you've got a pretty good argument about the corrective payments. I'm having a hard time understanding how the penalties and the fees fall within coverage.
Yes, Your Honor, that was not an issue that was directly addressed on summary judgment, hence why it's not more directly addressed on appeal. The amounts that NAOS incurred to investigate and resolve these errors, such as the amounts it incurred to hire an ERISA counsel and also an accountant, are addressed under the supplementary provisions of the policy. So the policy, like many insurance policies, has a primary coverage language, and that's the language that is discussed thoroughly in the briefs, where it states that the insurer, Zurich, will pay the amounts that NAOS is legally obligated to pay as damages as a result of errors in administering its employee benefits plan.
That's where I want to stop you, the phrase legally obligated, because it appears to me that there was a timing problem for your client. Eventually, probably, those payments would have been legally obligated, but wouldn't you agree that at the time those payments were made, they were not legally obligated? Or how are you defining legally obligated?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that. And the reason why is this case takes place in the context of the ERISA regime and the legal obligations ERISA places on a plan administrator like my client. And the testimony of my client's ERISA lawyer, as well as the law, states that when you have the sort of operational failure or error in administering the plan, such that the plan is no longer in compliance, there is at that point an immediate and ongoing legal obligation to restore the plan to compliance by making the corrective payments in the amounts that are required.
Okay, I can understand the argument that the corrective payments, all right, so these are payments to a legally distinct entity, the 401k plan, that are made out of the employer's own funds as opposed to the employee contributions, and that the law required that corrective payment. All of that I get with respect to the policy. But the investigation and the fees, there's nothing legally obligating that.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why I was about to get to that next stage before answering a different question. So the supplementary payments provision is a separate provision of the policy in addition to that first primary coverage provision I just read. And what it states is that Zurich, the insurer, will pay in addition to the applicable limits of insurance. So in addition to that normal primary coverage amounts, reasonable expenses incurred to assist in the investigation or defense of the claim. And so our position, and again, this was not addressed in depth in the papers because it was not an issue presented on summary judgment, is that those costs of investigation and remediation are covered under the supplementary payments provision of the policy.
Well, is that a preserved argument? If it wasn't?
Your Honor, my client was
It's the first I've heard of this.
Yes, Your Honor. My client was not seeking summary judgment. My client was opposing summary judgment.
And the argument was that they weren't legally obligated to make these payments. And that was as a category, right? A categorical argument that applies to all of them. And you did not respond by differentiating between the kinds of payments to say, well, here's why these we were legally obligated under primary coverage, and here are payments that we made that would be supplementary and covered as well. You didn't make that argument, did you?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the reason why is Zurich, in making its summary judgment motion, did not challenge that certain parts of his claim were covered and certain didn't. They said the policy was not triggered to begin with.
Right. But the argument they're making, it seems to me, at least in the absence of any distinction between them, does apply to the investigation and fees, right?
Yes, Your Honor, it's a two-step process. And so first, you would have to say, is the policy triggered at all? And that was the issue on summary judgment. Is there any portion of this policy that constitutes a legal obligation that would trigger coverage?
Right.
Only if you got past that first step would you reach the second step of, well, for these other investigators.
And you made an argument. We were legally obligated, and the district court employed a very narrow definition of damages that may be wrong, but it only, if it is wrong, it only helps you in part. And you didn't make an argument about why it wouldn't be true as to the other part.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that issue was never before the district court. It was never reached because you would have to resolve first if there was coverage at all under the policy before you could reach the secondary question of whether the separate supplementary coverage comes into play. Zurich never argued in our reading of the case that if this was covered, if there was...
You didn't point this out to the district court, that there's going to be two different categories for these payments. They made an argument these are not covered, and it looked, at least on the face of it, it looks like maybe some of it's not. You didn't point out to the district court, hey, well, there are two different things going on here. Weren't you obliged to do that?
Your Honor, I would submit that based on the issue and the argument that was presented to the district court, we were not. That specific argument had not been made, and that argument would only come
by you. It was not made by you.
I would submit that it was not made by Zurich in moving for summary judgment. Zurich's ground for summary judgment.
I mean, their argument was that these aren't covered. These are not damages that you were legally obligated to pay. And that's, you seem to be saying, well, that's true. They're not.
Yeah,
and,
yes,
you, and, you, and then, you, but you could have pointed out to the district court, but we get them anyway. Here's why. And you didn't.
I believe you accurately summarized the proceeding, Your Honor. I think
okay.
Our disagreement is on the legal effect. You know, we have no dispute that the attorney's fees were not covered by this first part that has the legal obligation.
Yeah.
What we would say is if you agree that the district court erred and that we do have a legal obligation to pay the compensatory damages, then there's a secondary policy provision that was not at issue on summary judgment.
Because it was not raised. It was not identified to the district court at all.
Yes, Your Honor. It was not presented in the...
And it's not been presented here in your briefs, right?
I'll have to get the exact quotation. It was actually mentioned in our brief, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't have the exact reference off my head.
Okay.
I recognize my time is up.
Do you have any questions?
I'm just wondering, in this instance, it doesn't appear that there's any debate that eventually your client had to account for the money and the placement of the money. I'm just still struggling with a situation in which there could be a debate about whether or not this money was legally obligated. And without a lawsuit or a court order or an injunction of some sort to confirm that for purposes of insurance coverage, how are you not taking away the insurance company's independent ability to make that determination for itself, absent, again, a judicially imposed requirement?
Your Honor, I believe there's several elements to that question, so I'll try to address them succinctly, and, of course, the court could cut me off if I go too long. First, I believe this is different than the ordinary tort case, where there is a undefined potential liability. Here, the liability, the legal obligation to pay these monies to the plan, is established by ERISA at the time that the deficiency arises.
And the insurance company could come in and argue that, in fact, you made an error of law and you weren't required to make these corrective payments, in which case the insurance company would win, but that's not what's happened here. The insurance company's not making that argument.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And in fact, Ms. Lisa Kaplan, who was Zurich's corporate representative, conceded that she had no reason to dispute that. I believe that was actually Ms. Dana Rickoff, their claims counsel, conceded that she had no reason to dispute the legal obligation to make these payments.
Okay.
Judge Abuda, if that's addressed your question.
That's fine.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, Mr. Schatz.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Steve Schatz. I represent Zurich American Insurance Company together with my partner, Steve DeFrank. According to the notice from the 11th Circuit, you wanted us to address the waiver issue, so I've come here to address the waiver issue.
Well, what we asked you to address is whether our decision in Aegis Electric and Gas bears on that issue, right?
It directly bears on that issue, Your Honor. Your
opponent says that it's a dicta. Is that right?
It is not, because it is then followed by Century Communities versus Selective Way. And so now you've got two cases that this court has decided in which it distinguishes.
You're saying that because it cites another case, it's not dicta?
That could be dicta, but this.
Are you saying that it is dicta insofar as Aegis? Mr. Schatz, is it dictum?
It is not dicta.
Why not?
It is a holding by the court that addressed whether there was a waiver issue that was brought up by the defendant in that case. And then based upon that holding, this court then decided
the coverage issue.
The coverage issue. And then, based upon that holding, the court issued the community, the century communities versus Selective Way.
Okay. And you're saying the case that we cited also held the same thing?
Correct. In other words, particularly in the Aegis case, the question of waiver had to do with a coverage defense, and that was, is this alleged claim even a loss or under the insuring agreement, just as in this case, Zurich has contended that the claim made by North American is not, or is a coverage defense, so cannot be waived.
Right. Well, let's talk a bit about the district court's ruling. Seems to me that the corrective payments that were made by OnSite to the 401k plan are potentially covered here. The 401k plan is a distinct legal entity. OnSite makes these payments from its own funds as opposed to the employee contributions, is what should have been invested in 401k. At least for that, I'm having a hard time understanding why the district court didn't err.
Because there has to be a claim of liability against the insured in the first instance. And there was not a claim for liability against the insured in the first instance in this case. It made a mistake. It then found out it made a mistake and on its own corrected that mistake by making payments to the IRS fund. It could have chosen not to make those statements and been penalized, but it did make those corrective payments. And those corrective payments was its own decision and its own reimbursement of its mistake.
Well, so you just recognized, though, that if they hadn't made those payments, debated whether or not those payments correct, they could have faced additional penalties. So I have the same question for you. How are you defining legally obligated? And in your view, is this just a timing issue that North American should have just waited a little while longer for a court decision to tell them or a lawsuit?
If one of the employees had sued or made a claim against NAOS saying, hey, you took some of my 401k money or didn't credit me appropriately for my 401k money, then there would be a claim for liability.
Right. But here's the problem. Here's what your policy says. We will pay those sums that OnSite becomes legally obligated to pay as damages because of an act, error, or omission of OnSite in the administration of OnSite's employee benefits program. It doesn't say anything about the employee having to make a claim beforehand.
This goes.
It says if they were legally obligated to pay for their mistake, then it's covered. What am I missing?
I think you're missing a general principle of insurance law, and that is when you issue a liability policy, that is the fundamental part of a liability policy.
So the fundamental policy of insurance law is that the insured has to wait longer for the employee's suffering, for that employee to make a claim about it, and it's a fundamental principle of insurance law that we don't want these mistakes corrected as quickly as possible.
That there has to be a claim to begin with. That there has to be some.
Even though the language of the policy says nothing about that claim,
there has to be some liability.
There is liability. Federal law required them to make these corrective payments. Do you agree with that?
I will concede that, yes.
Okay.
That they had to make corrective payments.
Isn't that a problem for you? I mean, I think you're right to concede it. But if you concede it, doesn't that mean it's legally obligated?
No, because...
But where are you getting the definition of legally obligated from? Maybe that's the way I should ask it.
Well, I think the district court, and I don't disagree, is that it looked to Black's Law Dictionary and said that damages, legally obligated for damages, means liability that is owed to a third party. And so...
Why isn't this...
This is a third party, right? The 401k is a third party. It's a legally distinct entity under federal law, isn't it?
It is a governmental agency for which they have not made any liability claim. And the key is liability claim.
They didn't make a claim. You keep talking about the absence of a claim, a formal complaint, so to speak. But there's nothing in the language of the policy that required that.
It talks about the duty to defend. It talks about a lawsuit.
It contemplates that there could be a lawsuit about it, right?
Correct.
But it doesn't require that there be one.
What this is what the type of policy that this would cover would be a first-party property.
They saved you money. They saved you money. The policy would have required that if there was a lawsuit, you would have not only had an obligation to pay, but also an obligation to defend, right? And you would have to hire lawyers, defend them, go through all of that. But they discover their mistake. They make a corrective payment. They settle with what they're legally obligated to do for their employee, saving you money. And you're saying it's a fundamental nature, it's a fundamental element of insurance law that they had to wait longer for the employee to suffer and for there to be a formal complaint that cost you more money?
Yes. And if you look at the Hathaway case that this court decided, that same thing, where the contractor voluntarily said, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and make repairs because the owner has complained that my construction of this project has caused defects.
Yeah, but that's not unless and until a court arbitrates that, there's no legal obligation to pay it. There, in the absence of a court arbitrating anything, you've conceded that there is a legal obligation, that is, the law requires that North American pay these sums. So it seems like that's different. I mean...
Well, I guess it had the option of not paying the sums and being penalized. So was it legally obligated?
Well, I mean, you've conceded that the law required them to pay it, right?
Correct.
Doesn't that mean they were legally obligated? Why doesn't that mean they were legally obligated? If the law requires them to pay it, why does there need to also be a claim? Isn't that redundant?
Because that is a basic principle of insurance, that you pay for a premium, and that premium is, hey, when I am liable to a third party for something I did negligently or wrongfully, and you make a claim against me, you're going to cover me for this. Well, no one has made any sort of liability claim.
But
they made a mistake, and so they went ahead and paid restitution or however you want to.
All right.
That mistake.
Let me ask it to you this way. It seems to me like the question about whether someone is legally obligated turns on whether there must be an arbitration to determine whether they are required under the law to pay something, okay? And maybe you should tell me why that's not right.
I think there has to be a claim, and what we had here was a voluntary payment to correct.
Why is that the case? Why does there have to be a claim if there's not? You don't need to have an arbitration to know that there is an absolute right.
I think you're talking about the timing thing, that there would first have to be a decision or a judgment or an arbitration on...
Well, I'm talking about, you referred to Hathaway, right? And in that situation, I mean, the person whose house it was could scream up and down that they wanted their money, but there wasn't a legal obligation until such time as a court determined that all of the defects were in fact caused by the repair person, right? Here, we know that the defect, that is, the nonpayment, was caused by North American. We also know that North American was required by law to pay those monies. What is there left to be determined?
It was a voluntary payment when they did not, at a time when they did not have to make that.
The regulations state that a failure to make that contribution must be fully corrected. I don't see how that's voluntary. I mean, it's not like they have a choice. They had to do it.
And they could have bought business income insurance that would have protected them for that, where there was a lot, for example, a loss of income for having to pay for this kind of loss instead of liability insurance, where it is for third-party injured people, injured persons, or damaged persons making a claim against the insured.
Tell me this. Is it your position that not only was there not a claim, but that there's no obligation until a court orders it?
No, if there is a claim and or suit is brought, then the duty to defend mm-hmm. is triggered.
Mm-hmm. And, well, that's just a duty to defend. They're not. Are they legally obligated yet to pay until there's a court order?
Not until there's a duty to indemnify. Correct. The duty to indemnify depends on an award.
Do they have to lose the suit? You have to defend them, and they have to lose. Mounting the cost, this fundamental principle of insurance law, and it's only then that you'll cover it,
or if you settle it.
Well, how would you settle? Why would you settle it? Because they're not legally obligated to pay. There's no court order yet.
No,
that's to me. You've led right into what to me makes this a just ridiculous argument. You would by that theory. You wouldn't even settle such a claim.
You would settle such a claim because the insured is
their mistake here was that they settled it quicker by just paying up
and breached the terms of the contract.
They didn't breach the terms of the contract. Something in the contract that forbade them from doing that.
Yes, the voluntary payment condition says you cannot voluntarily make a payment without our consent and knowledge. And there's tons of case law on that. Is
that a voluntary payment to settle a suit?
It's a voluntary payment for any claim or suit to, if you do
but,
that
but
without
as opposed
knowledge.
To the actual amount owed that about which there's no dispute?
Now you're talking, see, the fact that you said the actual amount owed goes back to first-party insurance, that this is the type of claim that should be covered by a business income first-party policy, okay. Not a liability policy where someone else has been damaged.
All right, Mr. Schatz, I don't know if we're making any more progress. I think we've had 15 minutes. Let's hear from Mr. Gunner.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to begin by addressing the court had several questions about how do we define a legal obligation? Well, fortunately, I don't have a dictionary with me here, but I can tell you that under Georgia law, we don't need a dictionary because Georgia law is clear that when we're interpreting an insurance contract, we need to look at how a layperson would understand the meanings of the words.
Well, when I look at damages in Brian Garner's A Dictionary of Modern Legal Usage, it includes compensation in money for a loss or damage.
Yes, Your Honor, which we contend falls squarely within the type of loss that NAO sustained. But at a high level, what we are dealing with here is money that NAO was obligated to pay under federal law. Just the same as we all have the obligations to pay income tax to the IRS every year. And I would suggest that if you asked any person off the street, do you have a legal obligation to pay your taxes to the federal government, the answer would be yes, because that's plain and simple how the term legal obligation is commonly understood. Now, my colleague, Mr. Schatz, has raised some questions about this voluntary payment condition of the policy, which one of the arguments made below that the district court did not reach. However, if you look at Georgia law on what is a voluntary payment in an insurance policy, the Georgia Supreme Court has stated that a voluntary payment is one that does not constitute a legal obligation. So no matter how you look at this question, we come back to the same central fact that NAOS was legally obligated to make these payments, and by making these payments, it did not violate any condition of the policy. We also discussed whether there was a lawsuit or a claim requirement in the policy. Well, again, if you look at the testimony of Ms. Kaplan, who was NAOS's corporate representative, she testified that there was no lawsuit requirement. She said that the policy coverage for legal obligations is, quote, not limited to lawsuits, end quote. And regarding this principle of insurance law, well, first I would argue of whether a amorphous principle can actually change the black and white letter of the policy. Georgia law is also clear that an insurance contract is to be strictly construed against the insurer and in favor of the insured. We certainly should not interpret it in line with some amorphous idea of principles of insurance law. But regardless, this is a classic third-party claim. I think there's no dispute between us. So the first-party claim is when you drop a hammer on your own toe and seek coverage for those injuries that you sustained. A third-party claim is when I drop my hammer on Mr. Holly's toe and have to pay Mr. Holly for the damage that I caused him. In this case, NAOS made errors that damaged the third-party plan and the third-party plan participants by depriving them of the tax advantage retirement contributions and earnings to which they were entitled, and the payments were made pursuant to a legal obligation to compensate those third parties for the damages caused. And lastly, before my time expires, Chief Judge Pryor, I'd like to address the dialogue that we had regarding the supplemental payments, and hopefully maybe I can bring some clarity back to that issue. First, we did address the supplemental payments provision on pages 26 and 37 of our brief. But more important, I think you can best understand this issue by thinking of it as one of liabilities versus damages. In their summary judgment motion, Zurich moved for summary judgment on liability. On page 13 of the district court's opinion, it summarized their argument as that there is no coverage under the policies for plaintiff's claims because plaintiff had no obligation to pay liability damages to a third party, and thus the policy's insuring agreement was never triggered. There was never any liability under this policy from the beginning. Zurich made no argument on the specific damages that would be covered if there actually was coverage under the policy, and we would submit that is the supplemental payments issue, an issue that was never presented to the district court. It was a question of what damages can be compensated by this policy if there is coverage, and therefore there was no issue before the district court that we had to respond to regarding whether these particular costs of investigation and remediation were covered. Finally, in closing, I'll address the Century Communities decision. Your Honor, that was an unpublished decision. It is not precedential, and it did nothing more than repeat the same footnote from Aegis Electric that is clearly not a central holding in the case, but was rather dicta commentary on that particular panel's interpretation of Hoover. And for the reasons explained in our brief, we would ask the court to reverse the district court and hold that this is a covered claim, that in the alternative, Zurich waived its non-coverage defense. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll move to the last case for today, Fulton versus